Welcome to a special edition of the Issue Is podcast this week from Washington, D.C. We got about a day's notice that the governor was headed to our nation's capital this week for a series of meetings and to accept this big education award. And thanks to my bosses, we decided, let's go. We knew that we would have a chance to interview him and be with him at the White House amid all this speculation about his future, about Joe Biden's future, about where we go as a country. And it was an extraordinary trip. This interview has already been written about a ton, hundreds of thousands of views on lots of different tweets, multiple news organizations from sports to politics to news to all different, all writing about this. It's one of the most high-profile things we've ever done. So here on the Issue Is podcast, we are going to give an even longer version of the interview than you've seen on TV with stuff that is exclusive for this podcast. But let's begin with a bit of a recap of the trip, starting at the White House.
How you feeling?
Did you fly in yesterday?
We did.
Governor Gavin Newsom enters the White House amidst a flurry of national stories speculating whether he wants to run for the White House.
I've tried to say no, no way, in every way I possibly can, including saying I don't know what else. I don't know what language. In fact, I may need advice and counsel on what's the language to express absolutely no.
During the trip, Newsom meets with Vice President Harris, First Lady Dr. Jill Biden, and White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain.
Talking about the number one issue in California, which is mental health and homelessness, what's happening in the streets, sidewalks.
The governor accepts a national award on behalf of California from the bipartisan National Forum on Educational Policy. Newsom blasting Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and other red state leaders.
I do believe education's under assault in ways that I've never experienced in my lifetime.
This organization honoring California's record investment in long-term educational programs, including universal pre-K, after-school programs, summer school, and child savings accounts.
What do you think the rest of the country can learn from California when it comes to education?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, I've said it in a different context. Our approach is as different as daylight and darkness.
The governor also heading to Capitol Hill for a series of legislative meetings, including with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. He talks with Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy, co-author of the recently passed bipartisan gun reform bill.
And I expressed my pride and appreciation, but also my frustration that the bill was, I want to be fair, it was inadequate to the realities in the world we're living in, but more than we could ever imagine and hope for, considering the constraints. And so he's a hero to me in this movement.
Now to the interview itself, our extended sit-down interview with Governor Gavin Newsom.
Governor Newsom, welcome back to The Issue Is in D.C. for the
Washington,
first time.
D.C. Don't boo. Don't scream. I know we're here. I know we're home soon.
It is a wild to be here, but the sort of opening question is, what does this trip actually do for the people back at home?
It's about bringing money back home. I mean, at the end of the day, you got to show up, you got to make a case, and there is billions, hundreds of billions of dollars that's out there that hasn't been sent to states large and small across this country. People are converging to get these dollars, these competitive grants, and we got to make sure we show up and deliver for the people of California, particularly in one area disproportionately. With all the stimulus money, a lot of it went out categorical, meaning everyone got a percentage based on population. But there's a lot of competitive grants in transportation notably. So if you're thinking down in Los Angeles in particular, we've got all these big projects, we've got 2028 coming up, the Olympics and all this opportunity, we've got to fill those voids, fill those gaps, and that's why it wasn't surprising to see some of your county supervisors out here doing exactly the same thing.
Let's talk also about what your conversations were like with people. You said your message was, use me, use the states. Inherent in that, do you think that maybe the states aren't used enough here in Washington, people on the local level?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think, and look, it's understandable. We're so consumed by all things Washington, D.C., who's up, who's down, what's going to happen in the midterms of 4 months, which Californian's going to be the Speaker of the House, will it continue to be Nancy Pelosi or a person from Kern County and the current minority leader,
Kevin McCarthy.
And so, you know, we have so much that's connected to Washington, D.C. more than any other state, for that reason alone, who the next speaker is, which is amazing abundance. You also have the Vice President of the United States from California. And you have the biggest, brightest blue state in America that has a $97.5 billion operating surplus that's delivered on all the Build Back Better proposals. So everything you're hearing debated here, we're manifesting in a different way in the state of California. So in that respect, that's interesting. In another dynamic and respect, we are also the most populous blue state in America with a Democratic president. We've got to prove ourselves. We've got to deliver on our promise and our role of governing effectively, not just campaigning. And that's public policy, and that's application implementation. And I'm here to talk about those partnerships, including just meeting with Susan Rice, the domestic policy director, reminding her that we're about to do 3.5 million college savings accounts using the stimulus money that the Biden administration provided Californians, $2 billion of savings accounts, up to $1,500 for every low-income Californian. That's a big deal, and it's an example of why we're here, highlighting good things and then filling gaps.
You know that that image of you walking to the White House got a lot of attention, and you know that you're not going to announce your presidential run on this show unless you want to and really make news. But we know that you've said in every single possible way that you're not running for president.
I'm going to say it in a foreign language. I mean, so maybe someone pays attention.
But you have also said that you're a big supporter of Joe Biden. You want him to run again.
Yes.
Right now, polls, though, show that he's got a 33% approval rating. Two-thirds of Democrats don't want him to run. You've been critical of the Democratic Party before. What more can the party do specifically to support him so that if he does run again, he wins?
So I have a couple observations. I was with another elected official with you at the Summit of Americas in Los Angeles a few weeks ago, his lower poll rating than Biden, Justin Trudeau. You look at Macron, right? I mean, leading stuff in this environment. After 2 years of the coronavirus, supply chain issues, international inflation, not just unique to the United States of America. It's tough. It's a difficult time. People are angry, frustrated. So being in positions of power and influence, by definition, are challenging. And in some ways, you know, your 40 or 50% approval, that's remarkable under the circumstance. All of that is situational. That said, just keep doing your job, trying to be the best person you can be. Don't be ideological. Be open argument, interested in evidence. Don't wake up with a closed fist, but an open hand at the same time. And this is an answer to your question. You have to also recognize what you're up against. And right now, we're up against the ruthlessness of a Republican Party. And I say that not naively. I don't say that even blithely. That's not a cheap shot. You see what's happening to all the progress we've made in the 21st century. All of the rights that we in many ways have taken for granted that have been afforded since the 60s are being rolled back in real time. This is a totally different moment. And we have to wake up with a different mindset, and not just the old mindset in terms of just a collaborative mindset, a cup of tea, and everyone's going to work together to get along, figure ways to advance the collective cause. And that's where the party needs to come in. Democrats need the Democratic Party, not the president, not a speaker, not an elected office holder. The party, the infrastructure, I think has to organize with more ferocity of focus, more determination to set the agenda, set the course, and put the other party on the defense. They are dominating the narrative. The facts aren't on their side, but they're dominating the narrative. And in this world right now, you dominate the narrative, you win. And that's what I'm worried about, and that's what I'm expressing.
So what is the narrative that Democrats should be saying, and how should they be going about that?
Well, forgive me. I mean, I think it's nice to know as a taxpayer that the state of California did the opposite of what Alabama. I think they opened a big prison with their stimulus money, and we're opening college savings accounts for 3.5 million people. I think maybe a positive alternative agenda is expressing that as a value proposition, and I bet 99% of people listening right now, if anyone is listening, didn't know that. And that's my responsibility, but I also think it's an opportunity for the party to highlight some of these things, but moreover, highlight what these guys are doing. I did it at the speech a couple days ago. You were there. I don't know that even you knew this, and you know a lot. 1,586 books have been banned in this country in the last 12 months, 204 in the state of Florida, over 700 in Texas. I mean, that's incredible. These gag laws that are passed, 19 of them in 15 states, this is a serious moment. It's not just what happened to the EPA, which is serious, not just what happened to gun safety as it relates to the Supreme Court, it's crazy, and what's happened, obviously, with choice, but it's what's happening underneath at the state level. And we need to focus on the good, and in that framework, what's going wrong, the bad.
And obviously, you're contrasting California with Florida as well. That ad came out about Ron DeSantis from your reelection campaign.
Yeah.
For an ad aired in Florida before it aired in California.
Yeah, I mean, unless someone was on vacation, not a great ROI. But I appreciate the point.
What was behind that? What was the idea there? And for people that say it looks like you're running for president because you're running that, what do you say?
That was an ad from a frustrated father of four. A son whose mom worked to raise money for aid to adoption of special kids, someone who works to get people with intellectual disabilities in positions of influence in state government, who was disgusted by governors of Florida, Ron DeSantis, for attacking the Special Olympics and threatening them with tens of millions of dollars in fine. I couldn't take it anymore. Going after the gays, going after people, othering other people across the spectrum, going after vulnerable minorities, and I can't take it. And so that was just an expression, and forgive me, it was personal in this context. Everything that I think our state is about, that I'm about, our values, they're going after them. They're coming after you, us, all of us next. And they're winning. He's succeeding. And I felt needed to be called out. And so I used a little bit of the campaign money to spare you from a campaign commercial in California, which you'll have plenty. I assure you, in the next 4 months, trust me, they're coming. I'm not taking anything for granted. As an expression of our values, because I'm proud of our state. I said, come to California. It was a point, hey, you know what? It's about time to have our backs up. I love our damn state. I love the state of California, our values. And you know what? Every night I turn on Fox News, One American News, Newsmax, they're bashing California. It's, you know what, kind of nice to defend this state, especially in those states taking advantage of us and taking cheap shots at vulnerable people. That's what that was about. Forgive the long-windedness.
Have you ever met Ron DeSantis or talked to him?
No.
What would you say to him?
Stop being a bully. Stop belittling people that look differently, act differently, love differently. Who the hell are you? Stop. Stop threatening people. Stop being so coercive. It's not power over. Power, dominance, aggressive, fear-mongering. We live this with the Briggs Initiative in the 1970s. We've lived this in California with Prop 187. Look what Abbott is doing. Abbott's talking about eliminating a fundamental right for people, regardless of their immigration status, to get an education. We were debating that in the 1990s. Watch that space. Watch that space. That was the Doe decision. They're going to come after that next. This is a real moment for diverse communities. And it's not just, again, DeSantis, it's Abbott, it's Kentucky, it's South Dakota. You go down the list, these red states, there's a ruthlessness, and they have an agenda, and we need to wake up. We're not connecting all the dots in ways we should. And I'm not looking to be the white guy on the white horse. I'm not trying to run the party. I'm trying to run the most diverse and the most magnificent state in our union. But I'm not going to run away from contrasting their approach and ours.
And one of the biggest contrasts you're talking about right now is guns. You signed legislation this week that would make it easier to sue gun manufacturers if something goes wrong. Next week, big piece of legislation you're going to sign when it comes to ghost guns. Can you explain real briefly what that does?
But isn't it amazing just what I signed last week? Every industry that has a product that leads to injury is culpable for that. Or at least has some exposure liability, not the gun industry, because they bought us off. They bought politicians off. Finally, we stood up to that, what we refer to as PLACA, and now we're giving people the opportunity to sue these gun manufacturers. I'm really proud of that legislation in the legislature. Next week, it's a big one. Greg Abbott, and forgive me again, everyone's like, not another state, but this is important. Wake up. I think people need to wake up. What's going on? Everybody refers bleakly references, reminds themselves, perhaps if they take the time to remind themselves, of what happened on abortion before the Roe decision. And that was what Texas was doing, something called SBA, private right of action to sue for aiding and abetting as it relates to the abortion and its procedure. It was clearly unconstitutional, but it went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court had an opportunity to say as much, and they said the opposite. Private right of action for individuals.
Well, they said nothing, right? They said, we're not going to decide on it right now, but you can keep going with it.
Keep going.
Right.
So they allowed it to go forward.
Yeah.
I, at the time, casually said, well, if you're going to do that and allow for that, you're going to allow that to go forward on the issue that will put women's lives at risk, we're going to use that same process to save people's lives. And we work with the legislature, Bob Hertzberg, who did an amazing job shepherding this bill forward, and I will have the opportunity of signing this bill that we worked hard on, that's modeled after that. And it will allow private right of action to people to take AR-15s, weapons of mass destruction in war, that's the only purpose of them, and ghost guns off the streets in California. It's a big deal. And that is an interesting constitutional question. And it will be very interesting to see what the United States Supreme Court does, because if they're going to abandon all principle, they'll reject our ability to go forward. And if they don't abandon all principle, we'll have a tool in the toolkit to really do something about gun safety no other state in America has ever been able to do.
So you're essentially banking on this being challenged, right? And kind of baiting the court here?
Not baiting the court. Let us go forward. We'd love to go forward because now we have 40 million enforcement officers. I mean, that's a remarkable thing. We can get these dangerous weapons off the streets. We don't have police officers to do that.
I mean, you think that's a good thing, though?
These are illegal guns. Yeah. The state of California has a ban on these guns. The ghost guns are deadly. You see what's happening in L.A. County. Yeah. The most conservative sheriffs and police chiefs and law enforcement officers saying these ghost guns are out of control. They're untraceable. They're killing people. We got to get these things off the streets, but we don't have the resources to do it. This gives us resources we've never had. So, no, I'm hoping it goes the way of SB 8, but I don't trust the veracity. I don't trust the character of this Supreme Court. I think it has been, it's an extremist. I really do. I think this court is way off course, way out of touch with the American people, the Constitution, and I think it's going to be an interesting path.
Are you for packing the court or adding judges or anything?
I'm not for no other reason than we'll have a court in 10 years after the other parties, that will be larger than
people.
Congress.
Yeah. Nobody wants that.
No.
quick note about last week, went on a trip to Montana with your family. It was not illegal. It was not against the rules.
Thank you.
It does bring up the question, though, about these red state travel bans. The L.A. Times came out saying that they should go away. A public policy question, does it make sense to still have those in place?
I honestly have not given it even 2 seconds of thought. It's never been an issue. I mean, we have my kids went to see their grandparents in the state and I got married, and my daughter's name is Montana, as we do every year. Never been an issue on our own dime. That's around state-funded things, and they conflated it and made it a political issue. But it's an open-ended question. I get, happened previous administration, they signed this in the law, and it's on abortion, not just LGBTQ issues. I get it. When I was mayor, we had a few of these things. It's an open-ended question. Obviously, it's brought to the fore. I'm not sure I'm the best, most objective person at this moment to decide. I'll leave it to more objective minds.
A couple of news items of the week from back at home. L.A. County looks like it's about to put in a mask mandate back when the rest of the state is not.
Yeah.
Does that make sense to have certain parts where you can literally go across the street and you got to wear a mask and other places where you don't? Is that a good policy at this point in the pandemic?
Well, look, localism is determinative. It's just a bottom-up frame. At the end of the day, I keep reminding people because I keep reminding myself, California is the size of 21 state populations combined. The conditions up in Northern California near the Oregon border are very different than they are in the southern part of the state. And so I do believe in regional approaches. I do believe in flexibility at the local level. Now you see the exact opposite, mandates denying flexibility at the local level coming out of other states. We believe in a different approach. So I think that needs to be tailor-made through the elective process and the deliberate process at the local level. I do think that's more appropriate.
The state of emergency has been way rolled back, but there is still some of that in place. Any end date for that?
Yeah, I mean, yes, but I'll tell you, thankfully, we have it in order. Let me give you an example. Every test, PCR test, that we get, the state law requires a doctor to sign off on each test before you get that test result without the state of emergency. Just think about that. Hundreds of thousands of tests a week. Would take a how many weeks would it take to get your test results back if we didn't have that state of emergency? The ability to have flexibility at the local level to move testing, as well as having surge staffing capacity. It wasn't just a few months ago. We had over close to 3,000 out-of-state staff that we had to bring in. It's incredibly important, particularly on the basis of this new variant that's going back up. Otherwise, we've rolled back 90-plus percent of all the critical provisions, and I think under the circumstances there's wisdom to maintain.
But couldn't you just change the law on the testing?
Thank you, and I
like
keep
that?
Telling legislature, especially some of these folks out there outraged, and they didn't even introduce legislation to change it. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. I mean, it's people just, it's the worst of politics. They identify problems and then offer nothing except pabulum and solutions. I mean, I'm all for it. Happy to do that. I've offered that for 2 years, but some of those things are difficult because there's scope of practice issues. They have consequences across a spectrum, and people would prefer to have a governor do it and then say, I would do it differently, and what's wrong? You know, I've been in this business perhaps too long.
In L.A. County, 717,000 signatures were delivered of people saying that they wanted to recall George Gascon. It's unclear how many of those are going to be verified, right, if the recall goes forward.
Right.
There's a good chance, though, that it will. Yeah. When we talked about the Chesa Boudin recall, you said that it was predictable that he would be recalled.
Yeah.
Do you think it's predictable that George Gascon would be recalled as well?
Well, not if there's not enough validated signatures.
Yeah.
It's an academic exercise.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know. I haven't assessed. The reason I was so quick to understand the San Francisco dynamics was my unique relationship to San Francisco that goes back, you know, generations in the context of my time as mayor and supervisor and working with many DAs, including Kamala Harris when she was DA.
And working with George Gascon.
And working with George Gascon in a different light,
right,
as the more moderate, ironically, to conservative police chief when he was working with us. So it's a different dynamic. And so I have to assess, and I haven't really given it that, I mean, that much thought. And, you know, I have an aversion to recalls, as you know.
Right.
And I'm not convinced that's the best democratic approach to solving every problem.
But is he doing a good job?
I don't know enough about the job he's done. I'm deeply concerned about the criticism. And we have expressed ourselves very publicly along those lines, including in Los Angeles, as it relates to some of the issue happening with retail theft, some of the issue was happening on the railroad yards, and I've expressed my own issues privately as well, and I'll leave the more objective analysis of his job to locals that will have the opportunity to make that determination.
A couple fun things to end. UCLA is leaving the Pac-12.
Yeah, I don't know if this is fun.
What do you think about?
Why is that fun?
Well, I mean,
I'm not sure it's a good idea.
No, I mean, let me reframe it. I know you're interested in this. UCLA is leaving the Pac-12.
I read about it.
Heading to the Big Ten.
I read about it.
Yeah, so they didn't tell you in advance.
I'm the governor, no big deal. I'm governor, state of California, but maybe a bigger deal is I'm chair of the UC Regents. I read about it. Is it a good idea? Did we have a chance to discuss the merits or demerits? Not aware that anyone did. So it was done in isolation. It was done without any Regental oversight or support. It was done without any consideration to my knowledge. Now, perhaps there was deep conversation with other presidents, or rather chancellors and presidents in the system, and the impact more broadly, not just to the UCs, but to other universities, including Stanford University and basically
UC
the Cal State system. I mean, if they had all those conversations, I look forward to learning more about them, and I've expressed that very clearly to leadership. And I think people in the state of California deserve answers to every one of those questions. And what does this mean for those student athletes and that will be traveling all across this country? What does it mean to folks that decided to take a scholarship at UCLA with an understanding of the league they were joining and the opportunities, and all of a sudden pass them up somewhere else and may have now a very different opinion? And if it was just about money, well, be honest about that. But are you abandoning your brothers and sisters in a system that created that university in the first place? Because it's many parts and one body. So I have strong opinions about this for no other reason that as a member of the Regents, we were never consulted, never asked for an opinion, and then didn't even the decency to provide heads up. So trust me when I say this. We're not going to be looking into it. We already are looking into it within minutes after reading about this in the newspaper.
I mean, if it's not about money, what's it about?
Well, exactly. I want to be fair-er than
I, mean, competitive,
I feel than I feel about this.
Yeah.
Look, UCLA, one of the greats. I mean, icon of icons.
John Wooden.
Come on.
Yeah,
and it's like it's not just sports; it's everything. And we just did record investments at UCLA. We're creating a new immunology institute. We put up $500 million supporting UCLA in Los Angeles this year, And you'd think even on that basis, as a champion for that investment, they would at least made a phone call or a text message before to say, hey, just want to give you a heads up. Here's what we're thinking. Don't worry. It's not going to impact Berkeley. It's not going to impact the rest of the system. We've got their back because we recognize we're a public university. And our top priority is the public students and our student athletes, or is it athlete students? I don't know. And we're going to get to the bottom of it. Well, and I don't mean this to create controversy. I don't mean this to create stress. I think just my expression of this is going to create more stress, but they also know my private conversations, and they won't be surprised.
Well, as a USC grad, I'm just glad that your anger is all at UCLA and not at USC. Well, private institution could do things differently, right? There we go.
I'm going to be more fair.
We talked recently with your wife about her documentary, which was great. It's really great, and I think it's more important for men to watch that even than women, as I said in the interview with her. It's called Fair Play.
Yeah.
It's all about the idea of men getting more involved in the housework, in the idea of caring.
And I'm not being uncomfortable here by moving around. Don't read into my body language.
But she talked a little bit about your role there. Is she sending you a message with this?
For 15 years. And she's right to do that, right? I mean, I had a different family experience because I was a single mom raising us. So I didn't even have even an expression of that balance in terms of what I saw and what I experienced. But Jen started, there's a game in Fair Play where you have cards. And the cards are sort of activities that many of us take for granted, you know, making a dentist appointment, picking up the groceries, taking the garbage out, the basics of life. And there's a lot of those decisions, and you see them all stacked together. And before the game, you make an assessment, husband, wife, or partner, spouse, and you say, what percentage, honey, do you think of this work you do versus I? And invariably, as a guy, I say, you know, all right, you're right. You do a lot more, so I'll say 40%.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the game, you realize you're down to like 1% or 2%. You're like, oh, gosh, how's this going to end? Yeah. That was how this started for me when she started putting this film together a couple years ago. I've increased the percentage, but it's not nearly enough. And it's a pretty profound and powerful film because it really goes to partnership, and it goes to the power of partnerships, and it goes to the power of personal relationships and how all of us are benefiting from finding more balance. And it's not to make guys feel badly or spouses of any type feel badly, but it's a real opportunity to assess and to level set about the disproportionate burdens on women.
And she said when we talked to her that you now make dinner on Sunday nights. What are you cooking on an average Sunday?
My Father's Day gift, greatest gift ever, the best. I'm not even making this up, an outdoor pizza oven.
Oh, wow.
Unbelievable. Yeah. And I finally figured out. I was buying frozen dough. No. Yeah. Learn how to make your own dough. I'm the guy. It's a four-hour hellish experience where you should just physically
see. So you're literally there making fresh pizzas every Sunday?
It takes me 4 hours because each one has to be done. And one of the kids says, no, not that. Why? No, put that on my brother. No, I don't want. So I have to custom make these things. And Got to get the wood right. Everything's about it. It's so much fun. But those are things that matter, right? That in the past, I may not have thought I would have been like, takeout's my night. I'll just get food, pizza to go, Domino's. So those are things. And that's all that stuff matters. And it does matter because the kids have fun with all that. I mean, we're talking too much about
right. it. Right. Just to wrap it up, what is your ideal pizza then that you make?
Oh, my God. It's the finest pizza margarita that exists on planet Earth, but the key is the tomatoes, the right kind of tomatoes. You don't overdo it with ingredients and just the right amount of garlic, simple blending, and of course that fresh pizza dough, and then you've got to have the finest mozzarella that you can possibly find, and then you pull a few, all this. Well, and then a little bit of Parmesan, everyone figured, but the oregano or whatever the other type is, not the regular part.
Well, I'm officially putting in the interview request for the next interview.
This is the worst description of the damn pizza I've ever heard.
No, next time.
And I had arugula salad, a master class in arugula salad. Okay. Master class with lemon, olive oil, a little bit of avocado, salt and pepper, very healthy, fresh. Excellent.
We do this on the Food Network the next time. Governor Gavin Newsom, thank you so much. And now I'm hungry.
I don't know. You're about to order a pizza, but not get mine. I get it.
Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Governor Newsom. A big shout out to photographer and editor Tony Butita, who went on the trip with me and was really just awesome to work with. We were there covering the inauguration of Joe Biden, and it was great to be in Washington when things are open and you don't have to wear a mask everywhere and there isn't as much security. And it was really a joy to travel with him. He did a great job. And a big shout out to editor Debbie Kim doing her yeoman's work back here in Los Angeles. A thanks to you for listening as well. And please tell people about this show. Let them know what we do here. Share it and feel free to send me feedback. I love hearing it as well. Thank you for listening to this special edition of The Issue Is from Washington. We'll see you next week from California.